I'm in the business of wanting to resurrect that triumphant beast.
Welcome to The Boundless Body, the podcast with the somatic doctor interviewing innovative thinkers about their perspectives relating to the arts and sciences of therapy.
Expansion and contraction, that is the primary binary inside the construction of your body plan.
Dr. B is a voyager in trauma resolution who brings compassion and humor to the adventure of healing.
You study science enough and the bottom drops out and you're just like, oh.
Enchanting elements of science, philosophy, and art. Discover the boundless body here on this podcast.
Back to the mystery.
Hey, good morning, Francesca. Welcome to the Boundless Body.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Okay. So Francesca Maxime is a dynamic somatic experiencing practitioner, certified mindfulness meditation teacher, and relational life therapy couples and life coach based in Brooklyn. With a rich blend of Haitian, Dominican, Italian, American heritage, Francesca brings a unique perspective to her work. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you. And I just want to add, I'm also a licensed psychotherapist, and so I am licensed in several states.
Okay, cool. So maybe we could start by talking a little bit about somatic experiencing, because we haven't talked about somatic experiencing on the show.
I guess the way that I work is more of an eclectic approach in terms of just being a somatic psychotherapist and coach, and sort of focusing on embodied relational presence. In the Western model of traditional psychotherapy, we're using as a basis Freudian psychoanalysis. And out of that, you have a lot of talk. And it used to be that the psychoanalyst would do interpretations based on what the client or they would say the analysand or whatever language they would use, but I'm just going to use therapist and client language. But in the psychotherapy world, the therapist would kind of be a carte blanche and sort of allow the patient or the client to sort of talk a lot, and the therapist would listen a lot, and then they might make interpretations or empathic guesses or whatnot that might be going on. And it's rooted around these things, drives and urges and different kinds of theories and philosophies of rooted in different things that what might that patient need or want and where they're stuck. So in theory, it's kind of good in the sense that there are some useful tools there. But in my experience, the Western psychotherapeutic model known as psychodynamic talk therapy, which is based on, is sort of the underpinnings of what a lot of people use as cognitive behavioral therapy, which is what they call an evidence-based treatment, which means they've gotten a lot of funding from a lot of different invested parties to be able to sort of come up with statistics that show that it's a successful model after 4, 6, 8, 12, 16 weeks of treatment, that they can help people recognize what it is that they're doing that's not helping them in their daily lives, and knowing cognitively through their mind that there might be a better solution. So you're identifying other options for you to engage in, that better solution might be out there, and that you can choose decisively in this moment, in the here and now, to make that choice as opposed to another choice. That's kind of the way I think traditional talk therapy has worked and its origins. And I did that as a client, as a patient for 20 years, receiving it when I was a journalist, when I was a Fortune 500 person in sales and marketing, before I became a licensed psychotherapist and life coach. And so in my experience, all of that was helpful to a point in terms of, like, you kind of knew, like, oh yeah, this was not really right with my mom, or something was off with my dad or whatever. But it was never this experience of, oh, and now that I know what might be better, so rather than drink a bottle of wine, I'm going to listen to soft music and soothe myself and whatever, rather than try to escape my pain and anger and frustration, I'm going to take a walk. It almost became like a double shaming. No, I don't want to take a walk, or I don't feel like I can soothe myself or whatever. So I know this is the right choice because this is what the model tells me, and this is what actually makes sense to a part of my brain. But I'm not actually able to kind of follow through with it. It doesn't work. Like, I can't muster the courage, and then I feel bad. Like, I can't muster you know, the energy to do the thing that you're telling me I need to do now. So that's when I found somatic experiencing, mindfulness, and all these other modalities like that involve the felt sense, that include focusing-oriented therapy, which is another modality that I'm trained in, which is a philosophy, but also an embodied presence kind of thing, which is more along the lines of, okay, so there's something in you that even though it knows this, feels differently. So the emotional truth from this visceral part of you that may be stuck in time has a different kind of response than what my brain knows might be wise in this moment. And so what I've learned to do, because I first experienced it as a receiver, is then trained in all these other modalities and now offer it to other people relationally through my client work, is getting to what the parts of you that are feeling differently than what you know might be a good idea. And that resides in your body and your nervous system and these old embedded narratives and stories that are emotional truths and unconscious contracts that live out in fight, flight, freeze syndromes within our bodies that are, you know, rooted in shame and grandiosity, all these kind of different things. And I try to help people identify those, contact those, move with compassion toward being in a different relationship with those, create space through mindfulness with those, and then apply those innerly, inwardly, and relationally to the other relationships that they have with people in their lives. I don't know if that's too much, but that's kind of sort of the scope of it.
Yeah. So you mentioned stuck in time. Mm-hmm. And when I hear you say stuck in time, of course, I think about trauma. Mm-hmm. When did you start getting interested in specializing in trauma?
When I was, this is 2015, 9 years ago. Yes. So as I mentioned earlier, I had been in traditional talk therapy for many years. And I think when my life sort of, I want to say, fell apart at a few different times. One, when my ex-fiance left me 2 days before what would have been our wedding after 7 years together and sort of being, you know, having bought a home and, you know, sort of structured my life that I thought this was going to be the future. And I was 35. I thought I was going to have kids with this person and have a life and all of that. And it just bottomed out. And I ended up really reeling from that. It took a lot to recover from that. And I didn't really recover particularly well initially, but then I found poetry and writing in this course that I had started when we were still together. And I kept writing. And then I had an editor interested in my work because they liked it. I had met him when I was doing this stuff with my teacher. And they published a book of my works. And then a family member tried to sue me and my publisher around the book because they didn't like it. And they successfully stopped the book from continuing to be published. And so that was another huge trauma because I was writing about that breakup with my ex. And I was also writing about how I learned that there were a lot of tie-ins after that breakup with some of the ways in which I had endured my father's behavior. And my father was, you know, in not so many words, sort of a narcissistic sociopath. He was very vibrant and dynamic at times, but he was also very abusive, very threatening, and very difficult. And I had tied that into the book also. And so what got killed when that book got stopped wasn't just the idea of my healing from that breakup, but also when that breakup happened, as is often the case, one loss triggers another loss, or one trauma triggers another trauma. So when I had my ex break up with me and I was writing about all these things about my ex, it unlocked a different thing about my dad. And so the trauma piece being stuck in time was, oh, I have a lot to unpack about my father. But between those two things, I was really, really like a mess. And so I'm working as a journalist, as a news anchor, I was drinking a lot. I was drinking too much. I ended up getting arrested in 2015 because I didn't use my directional, and I spent a night in jail, and I got out, and I don't have a record, and I was didn't hurt anybody. I didn't get into an accident, but it really was arresting to me to say to myself, what are you doing? Like, whatever you're doing to heal yourself or work on things in therapy is not working. It's not working. You're still self-medicating through alcohol and food and shopping or socializing with the wrong crowd or whatever. And as many people do in internal family systems, they would call them firefighter parts, and you call them adaptive survival strategies, whatever. I ended up getting introduced to a somatic experiencing practitioner at that time when I was arrested. And that person introduced me to a combination of mindfulness and somatic experiencing psychoeducation in terms of understanding what happens with your nervous system, getting activated, and then allowing that to release that charge that's been stored. And those two things helped me learn how to be with my experience, not just be flooded in my experience, because the flooding is the stuck in time. I can't be with my sadness. I am my sadness. Well, no, you're not your sadness, but your body is feeling as though it's going to die if we open up 1 or 2 or 5 or 10 or 15% to the sadness. Well, it's not going to die. But it required A, psychoeducation around that, B, what they call titration and pendulation around dipping into just being with 1 or 2 or 5% of the sadness, and then kind of taking a breath and orienting to the present moment, saying, oh, I'm here in 2020. Well, back then it was 2016, 2015, and I'm alive and well. My dad's been dead for 10 years. I don't have to fear him. This separation with my ex or whatever breakup is long behind me. The book thing happened. There's nothing I can do about it. But my body didn't know, because it was still stuck in that trauma place, that it was sort of in the present moment. So when I say stuck in time, I think a lot of us are living out of strategies that are adaptive at one time, because it's all we had access to. That when we start to learn these other somatic regulation techniques and mindfulness strategies to create a little bit of space between ourselves and our awareness and our experience, and holding that with a friendly and curious compassion, then we can start to kind of say, oh, now I can do what cognitive behavioral therapy wanted me to do. Now I can make a different choice. Now I want to make a different choice, as opposed to feeling like I should, but I can't.
If you enjoy the content, please subscribe, like us, and share. Dr. B offers a dynamic blend of therapeutic maps, modalities to help you catalyze, stabilize, and thrive. Book a session or free consultation at www.somaticdoctor.com.
Thank you for sharing a little bit of your personal story about trauma. Is this a book that you're referring to called Rooted?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A verse memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There must be some really raw lines in there coming from that era of your life with all that intense stuff happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there was certainly a lot of, I was writing about my life and a lot of ideas about feeling left, feeling abandoned, feeling rejected. That's what I was writing about at that time. And that was back in 2004. That was 20 years ago that I was doing some of this writing. It was when I was first introduced to poetry and writing poetry. I mean, I was an English major when I was in Harvard, but I wasn't actually writing poetry at the time. I was writing like screenplays and different things. I'm sure that if you'd like to learn more about the poetry, I can share a couple of links with you at the end and people can listen to some of the poems.
Yeah, so poetry has actually been really influential in my therapeutic journey and my healing journey. I ran into the work of Robert Bly back in the day, back in maybe 2003 or something like that. I started to get into Robert Bly through the men's work and whatnot. And I still periodically suggest that some of the men that I work with here in Silicon Valley, obviously during session number one, I'm not going to say, oh, let's have you read some poetry, because it's, you know, characterologically opposite of a lot of guys, right? But that's one of the directions that I want to move some men in. I want to move them in the direction of plugging into a different region of their mind, a more intuitive space. And I really think that as a somatics practitioner, it can be really powerful to turn towards the arts, turn towards the expressive arts, and turn towards poetry. And maybe this is an underrepresented aspect of somatics, is bringing in the expressive arts. Maybe not. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying. And I think it's great. I just actually ran a men's group this spring myself and can appreciate and understand what you're talking about in terms of introducing other kind of more right brain, more imaginative, expressive orientations to help with some of the healing work that can be done to restore humanity. By the way, you could say to get rid of patriarchy, to cut through it or to see it for what it is or whatever, but also just to restore your connection to yourself, because that's what it does. These systems cut you off from your own inner knowing and your own sense of self. And I think men, just because of the way in which folks are traditionally socialized, have more of that cut-offness that is encouraged, whereas for women, more emotional dialogue or feeling dialogue is more permissible more often. But I don't think that somatics has necessarily, as it's formally been created anyway so far in these psychotherapy models, they focus on nervous system regulation and neuroscience and those kinds of things. But there are other ways of doing it that are more indigenous that people have done for years. Drumming and dancing and singing. And when you talk about Stephen Porges and polyvagal theory, and he talks about humming, and you go back to things like Bonnie Badenoch and the way in which relational fields with the child, the infant, and the mother, and the look and the gaze, and all of the things that have to do with going back to Freud's oral fixation or whatever, there's something about the way in which our bodies literally vibrate and literally resonate with one another, that these other right brain modalities that you're talking about can bring into the fold, that just sort of a more cut and dry neuroscience or psychoeducation around nervous system regulation might not be able to do. It is truly experiential. So yes, I would encourage that. And in my podcast, I actually encourage that as well as the straight up trauma work. I've talked to musicians. I've talked to a few folks who do more of the creative work.
Do you ever get clients to write poetry?
I have, and also draw and paint and do santre. Santre, for those who aren't familiar, is kind of just like, was you're a kid, you play with figurines and stuff. Well, it's just a tray of sand that if you come into my office, there are a bunch of different figurines, like little G.I. Joes or flowers or trees or whatever it is. And you're kind of doing a psychodrama. You're doing whatever's happening in the story of your mind out in the sand. And then the same way, I give people pen and paper or crayons and chalk, and we've written. I'm like, what does that feel like? What does that sound like? What does that look like in your mind's eye? If there were a color associated with that, is it jagged? Is it sharp? Is it heavy? And if they can't name it in words, sometimes they can paint it or draw it, or sometimes they can use the sand tray to map it out.
Yeah. You mentioned psychodrama. Were you trained in that method?
No, but I've seen it done, and I think it's really amazing. Psychodrama and family constellations and these different kinds of embodied relational ways of externalizing what we would call parts or different actors in a system. So if you're doing ecological or systems thinking work, where you're taking in a sort of macro perspective of all of the different ways in which different elements interact, this is the embodiment of that. So psychodrama might have 10 or 12 people in a group or in a training where maybe the case is one person's issue with their husband or with their father or their mother or something like that. And then these different people will represent, oh, you're the aunt, you're the sibling, you're the neighbor, you're the whatever. And it's amazing. I've witnessed it, how people end up bringing to and getting out of the session, even though it's really improvisation. But again, activating that right brain imagination, creative, limitless, limbic feeling in the moment, it's really actually quite healing and quite effective and quite beautiful.
Yeah, I had the amazing opportunity to study with a psychodrama teacher when I lived in New Zealand, this guy named Max Clayton. He was an Australian teacher. And I just love, because Jacob Marino, the author of the psychodrama tradition, essentially. He originally called it spontaneity training.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think about sometimes with trauma, there's an undermining of a person's capacity to be spontaneous because of this stuck in time elements. Because it's hard to be novel and hard to be spontaneous if your psyche is trapped in time, exists, you know, in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that, being trapped and stuck in time and how that might undermine one's capacity to do novelty and to do spontaneity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that invitation. It's so sad. I was just talking to a friend of mine, actually, before we got on this call, who's a provider in Canada and works with trans population. And I've seen this happen where I call it like living through the straw. Like, you can only live through the width of the straw. That's only as much as what's safe. It's very narrow. It's very defined. It's very predictable. There's not a lot of room, but you know what it is. And it doesn't, nothing bad can happen because nothing outside that straw comes in. It's very narrow. On the other hand, nothing different can happen. Nothing new can happen. Nothing bigger, nothing more surprising. People equate surprise and unpredictability with lack of safety and with harm. And those two things that are conflated can have more space created around them when we root ourselves and orient ourselves to the present moment, to the here and now. So if I'm doing a piece of work with someone who's stuck in time and who isn't able to access this sense of imagination, one of the things that ends up coming up a lot, I think, is grief. And I remember working with someone who was, we were invited into a communal space of movement. It was a improvisational dance. And by the way, when you just said that this other person you work with down under New Zealand, Max, what was his name?
Max Clayton.
Max Clayton. Okay. I like that name. It just reminds me of improv when people do improv comedy because it's healing in a lot of different ways in the same way. But I was working with this group of people who are a bunch of mindfulness practitioners, actually. And there was a person there when we were invited to do some kind of free movement. It was in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, and there was a particular name for it, but I can't remember what it was called, interpersonal dance or free movement or whatever it was. And so there was no wrong answers. You could move where you wanted. There wasn't like non-consensual touch or anything. It just means you could move with and around other people in this group space. And I remember watching this person that I knew really not able to move, not able to get up. And it was so sad to see this person just literally sit in the corner, like with no supervision, no people saying you need to do the foxtrot or the cha-cha or the disco or the whatever, and not feel like it was safe to just move the body and to just explore and see. And then when I explored that with them later, there was a real well of sadness and grief around always needing to get it right, feeling as though any kind of thing that was wrong would be punished or would be, you would then be not allowed to participate any further in whatever it was you were trying to do. And so the emotional truth and the limbic learning, the bodily learning, what's stored in the nervous system is stay where you are. And that just cuts you off from so much joy, but it keeps you going. And IFS language, internal family systems language, the manager part coming forward. And yet it's cutting off all of your self energy in somatic experiencing language, your life force, your erotic energy, your sensual self, your exploratory self, that creative you that can notice different things and imagine different things like purple unicorns flying with blue rainbows, eating blue rainbows for dinner. I mean, a brain has to be able to just even say that. Doesn't mean it's what's going to happen, but who cares? We're using our imagination. We're not hurting anyone. And a lot of healing trauma happens that way too. Maybe we'll talk more about that later, where we use our imagination to go back and do an imaginal redo of a scene or a place in time that went down the wrong way, that we go back in and we say, using what you know now, who or what would be there to resource in a different way? And who or what or how would that have happened ideally? And when people hit that and have the courage to then re-envision what they would have liked to have happened, knowing full well what actually did happen and really holding the truth of that and the injustice of that, that's when the healing happens, because then they feel relating to that event is coming from a completely different place of empowerment and of healing and of completion. And that's when people start to live differently.
Yeah, eating blue rainbows for dinner sounds a lot more interesting than this executive manager in the psyche that's constantly trying to keep everything well ordered and trying to categorize everything and so on and keep everything in its place, right? Like this, the mobility, the psyche likes to be mobile, and so does the body. The body likes to be mobile. I love this image of the narrowing, like the straw, like this narrowing of capacity. And we could also say a narrowing of mobility. So I'm wondering if you've seen any patterns in this kind of straw image in terms of how it shows up in bodies, traumatized bodies. Like I was, for example, I was thinking to myself, this with this straw image, I was just working with somebody. I do table work. I do body psychotherapy on the table. I do a lot of touch work. I've been a body worker for 25 years. I've taught craniosacral work internationally for many years. Yesterday, I actually worked with somebody who we were, the primary area was the throat. And they felt like there was this, it's interesting how this is lining up, right? Because that's exactly the image that they gave. The image that they gave is they feel like they have a narrowed space in their throat. And this is a really common thing that I work with in my practice is sensations in the throat. In fact, I wrote in my dissertation about the throat and how this can be a region, of course, involved in expression. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what you've encountered in terms of patterns in your practice, patterns of how the body gets stuck. Patterns of how the body, either in expression or in movement, how have you noticed any patterns like that in the throat or elsewhere?
Sure. Yeah. So shame, I won't say the right thing. I can't say, I let other people do other things to me. I don't know why. Those are sort of the things that might sort of on the surface kind of be a little bit. Oftentimes the posture of that might be, if you can see me, but the posture of that might be something more along the lines of this kind of energy, someone who's just always making themselves a little smaller. Their voice may not be that loud. They may not speak a lot. They may ask questions here or there, but just to kind of check to make sure that like they got the thing right. It may be something like a tightness in the chest where there's shallow breathing, like sort of that panic attack thing that ends up happening here. Oftentimes the throat, I find, also is connected with the jaw. There's often a lot of anger that's held in the jaw, the tightness. And sometimes people report pain in the jaw specifically, but sometimes it's really kind of connected to this lack of feeling like you can be able to speak, because you're not, you're sort of like iron shut, you know? And I ask people, you know, well, is it something that wants to come out that is being held from coming out? Or is it something that wants to come out that's being blocked from coming out? Or is there something on the outside that's not letting what's inside want to come out? Or is it more that there's something here that feels like it's stuck with something here? Like we explore what that kind of more tactile-y looks like and feels like within them, and then see who or what is that block or that narrowing or that constriction or that collapse. Oh, is that a heaviness? Or if it is that something on you? Or who put that there? Or is that intergenerational? Is that ancestral? Is that all yours? Whose is that? And like kind of get to know what's happening with these postures and these, oh, there's a heaviness in your belly. What's that like? It's gray. It's a murky pool of sludge. Oh, what's that about? When did you first notice that? Oh, when my grandfather died. Oh, what's that about? When we kind of, but visually, to your point about being a body worker, oftentimes it's a sense of timidity that presents itself posturally as something sort of more like smaller. And I want to say none of this is bad. These are all adaptive strategies. It's that they were adaptive at one time, but it's sort of like we're drinking the milk after the expiration date has kind of gone by, you know? It may not kill us, but it doesn't quite taste as good or may not be, you know? And so you want to be able to know that you actually can drink regular good milk now. You're not stuck with this just because it's all that is left. Or all that you know, you deserve to have the regular, proper, fresh milk now. And that's available to you. Whereas back then, in fact, it may not have been. Maybe your parents didn't go to the store and you had to salvage whatever was left. And so you got used to that. And that's okay because you're still here and that's what kept you alive. Mm-hmm. So that's the bringing it up to date.
So you mentioned focusing several times, mm-hmm. and maybe you could describe to our listeners what focusing is. It's the work of Eugene Gendlin, mm-hmm. and maybe you could talk a little bit about Gendlin, maybe talk a little bit about the model, and maybe weave in, because we've been talking, you just talked about imagery. Gray sludge is one image that you offered the audience. Maybe you could just walk us through, like, define focusing. And kind of give us the lay of the land in terms of what focusing is and how we might work with a handle like gray sludge.
Yeah, sure. Eugene Gendlin was a philosopher, not a therapist, although a lot of the work he did was therapeutic. And it's the philosophy of the implicit and that it's rooted in everything is interaction. So this goes back to mindfulness principles of interdependence and Buddhist psychology and Dharma and all of that, as well as ventral vagal being, you know, Stephen Porges' sort of most relational, calm, you know, connected state. And then we are encouraged to divine the felt sense of whatever our experience is. And what does that mean? Well, a lot of times we live shoulders up. So as we were talking earlier in this conversation, you know, we have ideas and thoughts about things. But there was a lot of research that was done to point to the people who had the best therapeutic outcomes with their regular therapist, talk therapist or otherwise, were the ones who were able to access this felt sense, which I'll use the language that isn't a focusing language, but it's a coherence therapy language, to get to the emotional truth of the situation. So what is actually accurate in terms of the subjective reality of the situation, not the objective factual reality, how you felt about something and how that's stored in you. So there are six steps in focusing, and I won't go through everything. But, you know, one of them is like clearing a space. That would be kind of like in somatic experiencing, orienting to your current environment. Where are you right here and now? It's 2024. I would say, oh, yeah, I'm looking at my pansies outside. My flowers are bright. They're yellow. They're pretty. I'm looking, oh, yeah, my cat is over here basking in the sun. And then I would start to notice how am I feeling in my body as I take in that information. And I would just sort of say, oh, yeah. My body feels, I don't know, a little warmer. And I tried to put words or name to the experience that I'm having. A little warmer. It's a little more spacious. It feels a little less tight, a little more relaxed or whatever. That's sort of more this more receptive, inviting space where we're clearing a space and focusing to then be able to get curious about what wants to come forward freshly. These are the words that you'll hear in focusing. Meaning out of this space of like, there's a something that I'm feeling, like somebody might say, you know, they might come to the table like having an issue with talking to my daughter about, I was talking to my friends I went to college with, like, you know, about physical intimacy, right? They're a teenager and the parent might be nervous about having the talk with their kid or something. And, you know, they may have their own hangups about whether or not they had the talk or not from their parents and how that went or didn't go, or you know, they might have all this other stuff that gets in the way and they want to be as clear to their kid as possible, to be as helpful to their kid as possible. But there's stuff getting away. They're not sure what that is. And so that might be like a murky place. And so we might say, oh, that's murky. Yeah. Can we just kind of be with that and sort of say hello to this something that's here about talking to your kid about this issue? And we just sort of name it, say hello to it. Yeah. And then we don't do this in focusing, but it's an IFS step, internal family systems, where we say, how do you feel toward it? And that kind of gets the feel for whether or not we feel like we can work with it or not. But in focusing, they just jump right to say hello to it. And then can you ask it to sit next to you? Can you ask it to sit and create a safe space or distance between you and it? So now we're getting into what would be more like mentalization, more mindfulness, more accompaniment of experience or with experience. So you're sort of saying, oh, so there's this something over here, this issue, this dilemma, this problem, this polarization around what do I do when I talk to my kid about intimacy? And then there's me here with the problem trying to sort of work with that. Okay. And so what is it like for you to sit here and there to sit there? Well, it's, and again, it's a little bit like a gestalt empty chair technique kind of thing. So, and what's the space needed? Is it next to you on the couch? Is it across the room? Is it in another town? Is it on another continent? Is it another planet or galaxy? Depending on how big the thing is, you can create as much space as you need. So that's the beautiful thing, is you can actually still be with something, right? Because this is, we are interaction. So we are working in the relational field with us and our awareness of the granular sort of issue that's niggly for us, that's murky. And then from that place, we kind of get curious and say, oh yeah, well, what is that like there? Or, you know, what are you noticing about that? Or that's getting the handle on it. What's the worst of it? Oh, it's heavy. You know, there are certain questions that you might ask. Is there a color or anything? It's gray. Well, what does it want to do? Well, it wants to keep her, you know, it's a gray wall. It's coming up and it's being, you know, heavy and big like a gray tidal wave. Wow, that's big. Wow. And then I might interactively say something. And this is also something that I think Diana Fosha incorporates a little bit with AEDP, her model of trauma therapy, which is bringing the therapist into the equation and focusing. You might say something like, oh, when I hear you say the big gray wall or the big tidal wave, the image that's coming up for me is, you know, sort of a Hoover Dam of protecting your child, of wanting to stay safe, you know, physically or relationally or something. And I'm wondering how that lands for you, or what is that like for you to hear me say that or something, right? So you're bringing their awareness to your, I won't call it an interpretation because it's not exactly psychoanalytically that, but it's sort of just your idea, but you're offering it out. And then the client can say, that's sort of it, but it's actually a little more like this. And then they kind of sift through. And so you go through this process where you get to whatever, in focusing language, the crux of it is. What's the crux of it? What's the real handle, the piece that needs to be worked on in that moment? And then you kind of work with that and ask it all kinds of questions, like what does it need, or who can provide it, or, you know, those kinds of things. And that's when you use your imagination to see what else can come in to help solve the issue. And maybe in that scenario, the wise grandmother or the pediatrician or the rabbi. So then you might do a little role play and play that out and see how that lands and those kinds of things. And people will end up reporting that they feel differently physically in their body after kind of going through that kind of a process. And then they're kind of more able to approach the conversation from a place of more spaciousness and balance and less reactivity and less fear based on their own trauma histories or whatever.
So the handle could have felt sense components. It could have image components. It could have meaning-making components.
Isn't?
Yeah. And let's say that we're doing work with somebody and maybe they have some difficulties expressing themselves to their parents or, you know, their caregivers or, you know, somebody at the office or something like that. And through some felt sense work, working with the body and the sensations and through some tracking and some mental imagery, we find that the person has that the handle is that there's a gray sludge in the throat. Mm-hmm. How might you work with that?
The gray sludge in the throat. Who put it there? How did it get there? What is it trying to do there? What is it afraid is the worst thing that would happen if it wasn't there as it relates to you and your coworker in this scenario? How long has it been there? What's the texture of it? Is it mobile at all? Does it have a viscosity? Is it like a cement or a sludge? Is there times when it's thicker or more oily? What is it like to even notice that it's there and say hello to it? And what happens to the gray sludge when we say hello to the gray sludge? Does it change at all? What are you noticing is happening as we eat? Does it move at all?
So you'd ask a bunch of questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a process of inquiry. So what do you reckon is happening neurobiologically in this inquiry process?
Well, I mean, I'm no neuroscientist or, you know, whatever, you know, I only know things based on what I've experienced and some of what I've studied. But what I reckon, what I surmise, what I feel maybe possibly could be true is that when the part of us that has had an issue or a problem gets seen, gets contacted, gets the light, not spotlight, but the invitation of the light shown on it, met with a certain degree of friendliness, almost the way people are. Most people, and people also have trauma with dogs, but a lot of people like dogs. Dogs are usually, you know, depending on the scenario, kind of, you know, curious, friendly, tail wagging little beings. People approach the dog by putting their hand out like this. So smell my hand, you know, just see if I'm safe for you. Do you want me to pet you or not? Is that okay? It's a very sort of respectful interaction, the way that people are usually encouraged to encounter a dog that they've never met before, even if it's like a friend's dog. And that's the way we are with these parts of us that we contact. And when we do it in this way that has that sense of humility, curiosity, friendliness, and openness, that part feels met. And in much the same way that the dog, if it gets a good vibe from you, because it feels like your authentic presence is grounded and available and not threatening, because that is the vibration that it will pick up on with its little sixth doggy sense, it'll probably wag its tail and just be like, whoa, look, you're cool. We can be together. Again, going back to the relational sphere. Oh, it's more fun to play, more fun to flock. I don't have to just stay away or bark at you or whatever. We can hang together. And I think that's what's happening with these parts. I think that these things inside of us, they've just been, in IFS language and Charles Family Systems language, they've been exiled because it hasn't been safe. Nobody's been able to name them. They've been in the dark. They've been behind closed doors. And there are so many analogies I think about in Buddhist psychology. They talk about Mara and inviting Mara to tea. That's sort of like the devil, satanic temptation character that the Buddha sort of has opposition with and is sort of tempting Buddha to not be enlightened or how dare you be awakened, and sort of puts out these dancing daughters and all these sensual pleasures. And the Buddha's like, I am here. I touch the earth. The earth trembles to validate the Buddha's recognition of his own beingness, his own interconnectedness. And Marakaya is just like, whatever. Okay, I guess I don't work for you. You know, I guess you are kind of there. And that's why in Buddhist psychology, they call it inviting Mara to tea. So rather than have this big thing of this fear, like the monster under the bed, like all these exiled parts of me or all these parts of me that I feel because something bad happened to me or whatever, I need to push it away. But then somehow that gets conflated with I'm bad because something bad happened to me or whatever. Once we make contact with them in this way, that's more like, nope, you know, I'm just here and you're here. And that's why sometimes working with a good therapist or coach can help, or practitioner of some kind, because you're not doing it alone, because you are having somebody else whose nervous system is helping you regulate and hold space. Then they just feel like, I can breathe. Like, it's okay for me to be here. You get why I'm here. You know why I've been a big inner critic. I'm really trying to protect you. Sorry the strategy's been so painful over the years, but I really appreciate that you know that I'm really just trying to make sure that you finish school or that your kids are okay or whatever.
I really like this image you're using of the dog and the approach of the dog. And I'm thinking about safety, right? Like almost like a safety bid, a bid for safety. There's a whole neurobiology of safety. You mentioned Porges, of course, and polyvagal theory goes into that at length, right? The neurobiology of safety. And when you're feeling safe, you're in particular neural networks of the brain. And when you're feeling unsafe, you're in other neural networks of the brain. I'm thinking about, because I like to talk about safety bids and play bids.
Mm-hmm.
And like with dogs, what you offered is an image of like a safety bid. Hey, I'm coming to you at a certain tempo. I'm not coming fast. I'm not moving fast. I'm moving slowly towards you and I'm kind of offering for you to come towards me. That's a safety bid. But a play bid, often with animals, especially with dogs, is that the dog does this gesture of putting its head down. It's kind of like indicating I'm smaller than you. Even if I'm bigger than you, it's kind of the play bid says, I'm ready to be on bottom here. I'm ready to be smaller than you. And then often the tail goes up and wags a little bit. So that's a play bid. It's like, okay, you're ready to play? You're ready to play? Maybe you can say a little bit more about safety bids and play bids.
Yeah, I like that. And thanks for getting it back to the question about neurobiology, because to your point about Stephen Porges, just to put a pin in this is, when we're in ventral vagal, which is social connection, which is when eye to eye meets, you know, it's sort of an attachment theory, right? Where the mom and the baby, you know, sort of have the gaze, or when you're making love and you're looking right into the other person's eyes, when you're really connected in that soul to soul connection, like all of that helps with secure attachment and with the ventral vagal, like safe connection and attachment and safety feeling that we have with one another. And when those are imprinted in our system neurobiologically early on, because of course we have billions of synapses that are, you know, being built when we're especially from 0 to 2.5 years old and then continuing till we're about 25 years old, especially when we have those earlier on, then the more of a stronger foundation, you know, the better the rebar is that we have in terms of being able to trust or orient toward that as a feeling of a safe response of connection being safe going forward. The other two are in our day-to-day lives as we age. The other two are hypervigilance, which is when we have an activated nervous system and we're sort of more on alert when people describe themselves as being, you know, anxious or paranoid or panicky or, you know, those kinds of things. It's because we're kind of stuck in the ceiling, the sort of fight response or even the flight response. It's this sort of movement and impulse to hold a lot of charge in our system. And then the dorsal vagal, which is sort of this unmyelinated branch of the nervous system, we end up kind of slowing down, shutting down. It's what we feel when we have life threat, when we perceive that we are going to actually die if we do or don't do some critical thing. And that when we are in that state, we kind of just numb out. We can just, you know, sort of tune out, dissociate, freeze, you know, shut down, get really silent, withdraw. And then there's the parasympathetic, which is the rest and digest, which is more that ventral vagal sort of sense of activation where we can do a lot of, you'll see people do deep breathing or yogic practices and things like that to kind of get their body back into a more regulated state where they have more spacious awareness. And all of that, in terms of the brain, allows your prefrontal cortex to kind of come back online. Otherwise, you're kind of hooked up with your amygdala and your, you know, emotional truths and things like that. And coming from those places of, as Tara Brach, the mindfulness teacher says, limbic hijacking, as opposed to your prefrontal cortex, which is able to kind of see things a little bit more clearly. But anyway, so that's the neurobiological piece, which I didn't really name before. But as far as the dog goes, in terms of the play and the safety, when I hear you say like play with the dog and sort of putting its head down and kind of, you know, here with the tail wagging behind, I think what happens there a lot of times is the dog doesn't have a story about it not being good enough just because it's putting its head down. it humans think like, oh, if I do that, especially in patriarchy, especially with those socialized as men, but for all, you know, industrial Western socialized, you know, folks, there's something about that that's like either valorized as like, oh, you're going to go be like a servant, like the way that the, you know, in certain religious, you know, things, you have to make yourself a sacrifice. And, you know, like I just am thinking of my old Catholic traditions and all this crazy stuff where they would beat themselves in the back with, you know, some kind of a, who knows what, torture device or something. that was supposed to make you more holy or something, right? Like we're not, but I'm talking about like regular day-to-day 2024, like soccer mom, you know, corporate dude kind of shame, where that is like, oh no, I can't do that because then I'm going to be walked all over. So I'm going to be like grandiose and pretend I'm better than everyone else because that's what capitalism says I have to do. So I'm just going to always try to be the big dog. And then that's not relational at all. What the dog is doing when it does that is actually saying like, I want to let you know that this is an invitation where I'm okay to come toward and I want you to come toward because what I want to do is play with you. So when I do this, I'm actually getting more of what I want by inviting you to feel good enough to want to play with me. So it's actually very smart. And most people, because they're people and not dogs, overthink this because we have all these constructs of, you know, what it means for our status and all this other kind of crap that we don't allow ourselves to have that kind of courageous humility, which mindfulness teacher, you know, Joseph Goldstein, he calls it black lab consciousness. They're not thinking about it is what makes it work. What makes it not work so much in a human is that we overthink it and then we don't invite the play. And that's all the imagination stuff that we talked about before. Because when babies are feeling safe, you know, they go off and they play and they go back and they check with their mom and they say, oh, mommy, did you see me do this? And even toddlers do this. And as a 7-year-old, you know, oh, did you see my cartwheel? And, you know, then they'll go off with their friends for another 5 or 10 minutes and then they'll come back. And it's that interplay of connection and then exploration and then connection and then exploration that invites that more grounded, secure attachment. And without that, when you don't have anyone there to check in with, people can feel very neglected, very abandoned. And what the dog is doing with that play is inviting in the imagination piece that we talked about earlier, and saying we can co-create something fun and new together because it's just us. We've never been together in this way before. They're very much in the present moment. And then they forget about it and go eat their dinner or whatever.
Well, I really like that phrase, courageous humility. I really like that. It's quite nice. And I'm thinking to myself that this this play bit is actually a gesture of submission. It's getting close to the earth. Mm-hmm. It's a gesture of submission. And as you've described, there's really complex dynamics about submission and the human brain, right? It's like submission is equated with a lot of things. Like, for example, in politics, you don't see politicians giving up a point anymore and exhibiting, you know, courageous humility and saying, oh, you know what? You got a good point there.
Right.
When's the last time we saw that, right? Oh, you got a good point there. Well done. Nicely articulated, right? Because that would be a submission and submission is equated with bad in this kind of, you know, Western neurocentric imagination, right? You got to kind of like, you got to be the top dog. You don't want to lose face, right? So I think this grandiosity.
How's that working for us?
Yeah. Yeah, right? And you've mentioned grandiosity twice now, in maybe 3 times throughout the conversation. Now, I've done a lot of training in the Jungian tradition. And in the Jungian tradition, they are kind of like grandiosity hunters. They are, the Jungian tradition's good at rooting out and looking for grandiosity. And I think it's really important in this current conversation, if somebody is grandiose, it's going to be very hard for them to play because then they can't submit. You need to kind of be able to show that submission. And here's my tail and have some courageous humility in order to do that. So let's talk a little bit more about grandiosity and how that gets in the way.
Yeah, I like that. And I maybe want to sort of introduce maybe an image. I would say that the character who is on you know, like the, on the on switch of grandiosity, which, like I said, in patriarchy and this Eurocentric, you know, sort of westernized, you know, cultural model is what's lauded. It would be as if we were listening to a symphony and all there were notes. I'm a note. I'm a G. I'm a C. I'm a D. And I'm a note. I'm a note. I'm a note. Note, 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 note. Can you even tolerate that? You cannot. So what makes it beautiful? That there's space between the notes. There's silence. And that pause is codified as submissive in a negative way, you know, has the connotation of if we dip into or allow that space to exist or to be, we're soft, we're lazy, all this colonial, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, rugged individualism. You're not going to get anywhere if you don't do it yourself all the time. Grandiosity is a term that I use probably more often than other people because I'm certified in relational life therapy for couples and families, which is a model that was created by a social worker and family therapist, Terry Real, out of the Boston area. And he bases a lot of his work on Pia Melody and other family therapists. But the point about grandiosity is, as he says, that it's rooted in this sort of axis of vertical axis of contempt, where on the top is grandiosity and the bottom is shame. And whatever is vertical here is contempt. So basically, I have contempt for others, grandiosity. Nobody's as good as me. I'm better than everyone. And shame, nobody's as bad as me. I'm worse than everyone. I'll just complete the model. On the horizontal axis is walled off and boundaryless. So over here, all I'm doing is encroaching on you all the time. I'm smothering. I have no awareness of whether or not you want me here. And over here is, oh my God, I'm suffocated. I'm getting away. I'm going to put up a stone wall. I'm going to be here physically, but I'm going to check out mentally and emotionally, whatever. And so in the middle of those two axes is the circle of health, he calls it. And that's basically, you know, regulation, balance, equanimity, prefrontal cortex, whatever. So when you use grandiosity as an adaptive strategy, it usually comes from somewhere. And in Western culture, especially in capitalism and, you know, Western individualism, it comes from cultural values and mores. It's not la dolce vita, you know, la dolce far niente in Italy. It's not this sort of Aikido version of like, flow in, flow out. There's a time for you to speak and there's a time for you to listen. I mean, I look at my couples, you know, you're interviewing me, so I'm talking a lot more, but this is not a really balanced conversation. Whereas in couples that I couple counsel, there is no space of, oftentimes, of receiving. People haven't been taught how to receive without saying that, without feeling the need to defend. And that feeling of a need to defend is the grandiosity piece. But what is that really trying to protect? That I'm hurt. And what does the hurt do? Well, the hurt shames, goes down and hides. So then we just bicker. So learning how to be with all those different parts, then we can say, oh, wow, yeah. Yeah, you really just said a lot there, Joe. Yeah, I can see you have a lot on your mind. I'm glad you're sharing this with me. It's not always easy to hear, but I'm glad that we're talking about it.
Well, I like this this image of notes, like a cacophony of individualized notes with kind of like minimal silence to kind of place them in relationship. And I'm thinking about my own couples work that a lot of couples, they, you know, they are struck through with either uncomfortable silences or just waiting for the other member of the couple to shut up so that one can assert one's opinion, you know, sing one's note or throw down one's opinion or note. So I'm not really listening to you. Like one of the members will just, you know, I'm not really listening. I'm just waiting for you to be quiet so that I can do my note. And I think there's a grandiosity to that too. Like, we can get lost in that space, right? Of just kind of going into a trance or something like that of our own opinion and just waiting for the person to stop talking so that we can just play our note again.
Yes. And we've never been taught to listen. I think, again, back to Thich Nhat Hanh, he says, love is understanding. And active listening is an art that nonviolent communication is a model that teaches other places. Thich Nhat Hanh's Zen mindfulness Plum Village tradition has a listening and speaking protocol that, you know, people can look up. There's a lot of different ways where people can learn about what does it mean to listen when you actually listen and you're just like, wow, what I heard you say is X, or Y, or Z. And that's what we're trained to do as a therapist, right? If you learn how to listen as a partner, it's amazing the way in which your relationship will change.
Yeah, it's great. I was thinking about an image of like therapy and couples therapy in particular, but all therapy being a kind of cultivation of a kind of noise reduction function, you know, giving couples and folks like kind of like sound noise reducing headphones or something like that to slow down, to cultivate silence. And in case of couples, I remember this mentor of mine once said that he had this just extraordinary blessing. He said something like, may your partnership be infused with comfortable silences.
That's right.
Because there's so many situations like in therapy, couples therapy, where the silences are just struck through with discomfort, and either there's no silence at all, or there's just tons of discomfort, tons of resentment. And the silence is just not really a restorative silence. And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, well, what are some things that folks can do to reduce the noise? And you mentioned it before. I was thinking grief has a noise reduction function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, grief is such a huge thing. I want to just name, I'm also trained in intimacy from the inside out, which is a couples therapy model for folks through the IFS model. And that is a model that teaches folks how to be present, curious, embodied listeners in a different way, as does Imago Therapy. Helen LaKelly Hent and Harville Hendricks wrote that book, Getting the Love You Want, a long time ago. I do think that the silences, the ability to be with what is as it is, and noticing your attitude toward it is a key mindfulness principle. They call it the Vedanas, the feeling tones around something. So is it preferential? Is it dismissive? Or is it ignorant? Like you're just not, you don't even know what's going on. And because oftentimes we are drawn toward things we like and we try to avoid things that we don't like, and there's millions of other things that we're kind of unaware of that are going on that we just don't really register a lot for us, we end up feeling as though the experience itself is good or bad because we like it or not. But they're two separate things. The thing itself is just what's happening. Like if it's raining outside, it's not good that it's raining or bad that it's raining. It's just raining. And I may not like that it's raining if I wanted to go take a bike ride. But I can be with the fact that I'm a little disappointed that today's the day Mother Nature decided to rain, because I was hoping that I could take a bike ride with my friend and now we can't do that. And it's a little sad because I wanted to show her down the street over here in this neighborhood and go to this farmer's market, and we have to do something different. And so that touches into very low level grief around the disappointment of what is. But when I notice that I have a preference for it to be sunny and not rain, and that I am not happy with or angry about the fact that it is raining, and I can pull those apart, then I can actually touch into the deeper emotion, which is actually something quite more vulnerable. And vulnerability is a requisite to intimacy, which is a requisite to that relationality and connection. That's really our human birthright that we all crave, but so many people And it was just so brittle. We don't know how to handle it. So we come out of our defenses and that grandiosity thing, or we just withdraw and then we feel lonely. And so grief, that's a small example of like sadness. But I think that if you multiply that in bigger issues with the death of a family member or a pet or a loss of a job or a relationship or whatever, a lot of times when people like, yep, just get back to work or, you know, it'll be fine. Like, yeah, I'm going to go back to the gym or whatever. Yes, those things can't be good for you at a certain level. But if you're not actually also holding space for the other piece inside of you, that's like, wow, that was a hard hit. Wow, that was really rough. Like nobody ever taught me when I, going back to what we started the podcast with, nobody ever taught me how to be with my feelings. So I was my feelings. So when I had my ex leave me, when I had my family member threaten to sue my publisher over the book, I was so ill-equipped to learn how to tolerate, oh yeah, that's wrong, or gee, that's really sad, or gee, that's not right, or wow, that's out of balance, or that I became that. And then I tried to avoid that through drinking too much, and it created then its whole other host of problems. But if someone had taught me, it is those things, let's be with those things, let's hold that space together, it's okay, of course it's going to feel this way, that would have been a whole different portal. So yeah, let's cry about it. How long do we need to cry? Keep crying. You know, and eventually, I remember my mindfulness teacher, Jack Kornfield, told me when I was at a retreat and I was sitting up front on my Zafu and I was like crying, crying, crying. He's just like, pulled me aside during break. He's like, you okay? You know, how are you? And I was just like, yeah, you know, da 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 da. And he's like, those are the tears of the way. He's like, that is like, those are the tears. That's the charge that needs to come forward for all the grief that you've been holding. It's not a problem. But in our culture, you get 2 days off when your mother dies. You don't get 2 months or 2 weeks or 2 years to mourn. In Italy, you know, Italian women in black dresses, right? You know, that whole thing down in Southern Italy. There's a reason for that. It's like, leave me alone. I need to process my shit. We don't have that in this culture.
So I'm thinking about, let's say that we have a couple, that we're working with a couple. And we've identified that one of the members of the couple has trauma. Right? We've done some focusing work with them. We noticed that they're doing a lot of narcissistic bids. That's another bid. We've talked about safety bids and play bids. And then there's also narcissistic bids, which is basically like me trying to draw out of you compliments and praise. Okay, so this person is doing lots of narcissistic bids, and they're creating a lot of noise. And we've already identified that, gosh, it would be nice if they just slowed down and they could get in contact with their grief. And then we did some focusing work in the here and now with the couple, and we've identified that the grief sensation is stuck as gray sludge in the throat. How might we work with that with this couple?
This is why I have to write this book. I was just talking to my friend that I was telling you. I was talking to you before I got on this podcast about it. So shame is very narcissistic. When you don't feel like you have a right to exist, when you feel like at any moment you can be humiliated, when you've had an experience of unhealed trauma around humiliation, then you're going to foist all of that onto your partner and you're going to expect them to fix it, heal it, do the redo in real time. That was never offered to you. And that's really not your partner's job. There are some couples therapy models like PACT, which might say Stan Takin's model, where more secure functioning, you know, you can create that in the here and now with people. And I do think you can help with that. But I also think that a lot of what they say is true about, I can't fix my partner, but I can fix myself. So for the person who has the, and by doing so, I will, and when I say fix, I mean heal, have insight about, bring myself back into balance, you know, understand what's really going on in me. So for the person who has the sludge stuck in their throat that's looking for attention and affection, They might be so dysregulated that they're not able to bring any kind of awareness to their scenario, that they might just be kind of stuck in that. They might not be able to say that they don't feel like they have a right to ask for the compliment that they're fishing for or whatever. So if you know that and you're the partner who's non-traumatized, you might want to say, I'm wondering what's happening with you right now, because I'm getting a sense that you'd like me to say something, but I'm not quite sure what it is. Is it something about what you're wearing or something that happened with the house or something that the kids are doing that's different that you'd like me to name or say something about or you know, pay more attention to? So that's maybe a guess, right? It may not be right, maybe not be perfect, but it's something. You're kind of offering the olive branch, right? And the other person who's more like with a sludge or whatever, well, yeah, didn't you notice that I put out fresh flowers? Or didn't you notice that, like, you know, Janice came home with a straight A report card? Or, you know, who do you think was tutoring her after work? I did that or whatever. Oh, so that's, yeah, I did actually notice that. Or you know what? I didn't. And I'm sorry about that, because I did, now that I look at the table in the kitchen, I do see that there are flowers there and they're beautiful. And I love how you keep our home so beautiful and that you are always thinking about elements that I don't think about when I'm doing my spreadsheets at work. And you make our home into a place that feels safe and welcoming for us to be here. You can be a generous, Terry Real calls it a generous gentleman. Compliments are free. And what's interesting about the dynamic you're describing to me is when you offer them from a grounded and rooted place, along with some curiosity and some invitations, like, huh, I'm wondering if there's anything that I could do to add to some of this for, or gee, I see that you did these three things. Is there a piece about that that, you know, I'm not aware of, which maybe you wish that I already were, but if I'm not doing it already, chances are I'm not aware that you, if you would, you know, indulge me and tell me, you know, that I might be able to pick up so I can, you know, try that, right? Or then it softens the other person's system. Again, they're contacting that part. They sort of start to feel heard. If they're really narcissistic, they really have a deep wound. Sometimes we call it offending from the victim position in relational life therapy. They'll never want to let go because their whole sense of self is oriented around being a victim. And they feel as though without their victimhood, they will not actually be a person that anybody will pay attention to. So by constantly needing, protesting, whining, Eeyoring, or whatever, that's how they've gotten whatever sense of connection that they've gotten, even if it's been with a valence of resentment or irritation from another person, that for them and their system, it's better than nothing, because otherwise they would be alone. So sometimes we need to kind of like have boundaries around that too, to say, I love you no matter what. And the behavior is not something that can continue for us to be in this relationship. So let's figure out what's really going on, because I really want to show up in this relationship. I really value this relationship. I value you. But when I notice that these things are happening, it keeps me from feeling as close to you that I know both I and you want us to feel. And I'd like to find a way that we can work through that. Will you help me understand that better so that we can move back to a place of feeling closer? That's maybe what a healthy person might say.
Yeah, I like this image of the olive branch. Hey, I noticed that you're going through something over there and seems like you need something from me. Is that true? And that olive branch goes over, and it might be the case that that's done effectively, that the noise has been reduced enough so that the one with the gray sludge in their throat can actually hear them. And we might find ourselves descending down through the layers of the psyche, and they might find their way into the grief, right? Where it ended up being some humiliation that they had when they were young, or some dimension of their experience that in terms of being seen, recognized, mirrored, loved, supported, all that stuff, got thwarted or undermined in some way. And they might actually go deeply into that grief, and a lot of things would open up. That would be a different grief than the type of victim identified grief that might come out of somebody with the profile that you mentioned before, mm-hmm. which this is quite interesting, right? Like grief isn't always restorative or reducing noise. You know, it can have this kind of resentment based element to it where the grief is kind of like, I'm here because you did this to me. I'm grieving because it's your fault and that's bad and I resent you.
Yeah, the angry grief. I think maybe it's, I don't know what we're calling it, processed versus unprocessed grief, perhaps. Dick Schwartz called it a tormentor, where you're being mentored by that which feels not so great. So allow the grief to be your teacher and not force the grief to be something that you just try to get away from or use as an excuse to punish others.
Yeah, I like the word surrender, right? Because if you're surrendering to the grief and just, you know, not holding on to it so that you can do something with it, you know, then that could be quite useful, right? So I'm wondering if we can complete the discussion by having you say a little bit more about this redo, imaginal redo process that you've mentioned a couple times. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could use the case in front of us here. Let's imagine that, yeah, there is a humiliating event that we kind of drilled down to as we descended through the layers and the grief was starting to come and something bad happened. I guess we might have to make up the bad thing in order to talk about the imaginal redo, but I'm wondering if we could kind of orient to the completion of this discussion with talking a little bit more about a imaginal redo.
So say partner A is the one without the trauma or whatever for the purpose of this conversation. And partner B is the one with the trauma that has the sludge in the throat and is making these bids for having these issues. And we learn that it's tied to some sense of not feeling valued or not feeling appreciated or feeling exposed or humiliated or, you know, something along those lines. I might ask the partner A if it would be okay to do a piece of work with partner B in their presence and do with their permission and partner B's permission a little bit of work around some of the things that we sort of started to talk about around focusing. So yeah, I'm wondering when you talk to your husband John and you're sitting here sort of asking them or saying, you know, why didn't you say this to me or whatever, you know, what are you noticing is happening inside? Is there anything that's coming up, you know, for you and your body, you know, oh yeah, that thing in your throat. Is there something else it wants to say? Oh, how long has it been there? How old is it there? When did you first notice that? Oh, fifth grade. Oh, what happened in fifth grade? Does anything come to mind? Oh, Mrs. Winooski's, you know, English class when I was supposed to recite this. And I forgot the lines and I froze and peed in my pants. Oh, what happened there? I'm sorry. That's so terrible. You know, I can only imagine how awful that was for you. You know, while the other kids started throwing spitballs at me and Mrs. Winooski laughed and, you know, I had to run to the bathroom by myself and they didn't let me call my mom until the next period. Oh, wow, babe. I'm so sorry. Can we just sit with that for a minute? She deserves so much more than that. I'm wondering if there's anyone or anything that could have been helpful at that time. Well, there was nobody there. I was by myself. I know. That's right. You were. And in this moment right now, because we're here together, I'm wondering if we can just use our imagination of anything or anyone in the world, a book character, a movie character, a superhero, a deity, some other kid's mom or uncle or coach or teacher, anyone or anything that feels like it might have been comforting to you at that time, an animal, a tree, a place, you tell me. Well, my friend Becky's dad was so good when the softball coach yelled at her. He just, all right, so let's just bring in Becky's dad's energy. Let's just see what he does with that. when you know he's here. Notice what it's like to be with him in the bathroom and in the room. What does he say to the kids and the teacher? What does he do with you? Well, yeah, he tells Ms. Winooski to just, you know, say, this is not right. These kids need to be respectful. Whatever. Yeah, so this is not right. These kids need to be respectful. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so just feel that. And now what wants to happen? Well, I want to go to the principal's office and tell them that. Yeah, okay. So what happens when Becky's dad and you are able to go down there? Just let that happen. Notice what it's like, whether or not you're walking side by side, whether or not he's holding your hand, whether there's anyone else around, whether he offers you a jacket or anything for your pants. How he approaches the principal, how he talks to them, so you don't have to do it on your own. Yeah, just go inside and just see how that is for you right now. Notice what's happening to the throat, to the body, to the breathing. What are you noticing now? Well, he's calling my parents and he's talking to the principal about what Ms. Wozniewski did in there and how, yeah. And how is that for you? Well, it's good. I wish he was there. I know, honey. And that's why we're doing it now. Our brain doesn't know the difference between now and then. In this way, it allows the experience to actually create something new. So if you allow it, it will start to shift. How are you doing, partner A? It's okay. Don't have to say anything. Just give me a thumbs up. And now what wants to happen, Lisa? Becky's dad says that he's happy to drive me home or, you know, whatever. So he's going to take me home. And is that feel right to you? Oh, yeah. I want that. Anything you want to do on the way, like grab an ice cream or, you know, go to the store and go shopping for some new shorts or something like that? Well, I don't know. Maybe. We'll just see. See, check with that, you know, fifth grader and see what she wants. Nah, she just wants to go home to see her dog, Riley. You know, she just wants to go and take a shower and just hang out with her dog. Okay, we'll let him drive you home and be that. And just see in your mind's eye what happens when she walks in and sees the dog and he talks to your parents and you go take a shower and get changed and hang out with the dog. Oh, yeah. Yeah, now I'm just in my room reading my book and with the dog and, you know, they're down there and whatever. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I'm wondering from this place, noticing what it's like to look at your husband and to see. What is it like for him to see you and for you to see him in this place? See if you can take each other in a little bit different and see what it's like for him to have been with you as we bring up this fifth grader and notice if anything's different about him. And usually there's like a softening or some kind of a different postural. And maybe there's a few words. Wow, Lisa, you know, I had no idea, you know, that was so beautiful. Thank you for sharing. Yeah, Joe, it's been really hard. It's been, you know, like, yeah, whatever, right? And then is there anything you guys want to do? You know, that's a nice gesture. That's a nice look as a therapist. That's a nice look you just gave her. Oh, that's a nice, you know, holding hands. Great. But just go with that. Let that settle. Feel that in your body. Let that marinate. Let that absorb. Don't have to say or do anything here. Don't have to put words on anything. Just allow that to happen. And maybe just as we let that go, just maybe saying that this little one isn't going to be the one who's trying to relate to Joe anymore, right? That we're here now and that you're here to give her what she needs, just like Becky's dad did. That this is the relationship we're cultivating inside so that Lisa, the 34-year-old, can be with Joe day to day.
Awesome. That was just a very spontaneous. We were talking about spontaneity before, and you just spontaneously unfolded this this exquisite therapeutic story. So well done for that. So I'm thinking of it as, you know, like, the noise has been reduced in this couple so that then they can hear each other, mm-hmm. and see each other. You know, your pacing structure, you shifted into this kind of pacing structure of being in the deep work, right? Where me as a listener, I had three spontaneous deep breaths just by the change in the change in the tempo and how you were able to coordinate your voice and everything. So well done for that. And, you know, and neurobiologically speaking, there's a lot of stuff happening there too. And if for the listeners out there, we did discuss the neurobiology of mental imagery with Dr. Aldrich Chan in the last episode, talking about how the default mode network of the brain and the precuneus in particular, the precuneus in the back of the brain, is interwoven with the central autonomic nervous system in such a way that there isn't really much of a difference to the autonomic nervous system, whether something is happening in real time or it's being imagined. Okay, because imagining is in real time and it has direct impact on the central autonomic nervous system. So this is neurobiological work. It isn't just pie in the sky.
Right.
And if you want to review that episode, then feel free to do so.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're working with the brain. It's not just, we're working with some butterfly psyche, right, out there in the, you know, in a field or something.
Well, and what I want to just say about that for the listeners and just for just folks in general is, you know, why you cry at a movie, why you go when there's a tiger coming, you know, and you're in your living room? It's because our brain doesn't know the difference in that way, right? It's the same when you see Jason, Freddy Krueger, or whatever it is, if you watch a horror movie and you're like, it's because even though it's on a screen and you're sitting in a chair and you're in a dark room, that it doesn't know, you know, the difference. So in that way, that should be enough to kind of tell you, right, that there is something else happening, that we're working, you know, the way the brain is working with image and sound and all these things, that is very real, even though it's not true.
Yeah. Yeah. I went on the journey with you in this made up story. Yeah. I was there in the room with the dog and I was seeing extra things, like the dog is doing play bits.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and the tail goes up and maybe there's a toy and the tail's going like this. And then my nervous system actually has there's biological consequences. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling better. You know, like I'm got the tingle response.
Yes.
And so I'm there.
That's
you
bringing in your own resources. So we talk about, you know, as a social worker, strengths-based stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of talk with Kanthan and stuff and positive neuroplasticity over at Penn and everything. But this is you bringing your own resources around, like, spontaneously they're emerging. Because we talk about we have these trauma triggers, but we also have these, I don't know what to call them, trauma inspirations or something, or resources, you know, limbic resources or something that also exist within us, that our bodies and minds can find a safe space, like a tree or a beach or a dog or a room or a picture that meant something that was calming and soothing to our system, that we can also have access to, we're not using all of our energy to just be in the straw.
I'm liking how you brought in the straw image at the end, because there's not much room for resource, not that much room for positive imagery and spontaneity and all of that when we're inside the straw.
We just care about, you know, even if our breath is, we're breathing. And I'm like, well, what if she could breathe this way?
Yeah.
I don't know. That looks dangerous, you know? So.
Yeah. Spit that gray sludge out of the straw.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. 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 Or change the temperature so it eventually warms to the degree that it automatically kind of drips out on its own.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. Two path, you know, kind of like, I think there's a prioritization in the trauma resolution work writ large towards slowing down and self-regulating, which is good and very useful and important, but also, you know, states of well-paced activation, you know, just like warming up at a pace that feels good to the person. That can be essential too. States of activation are just as important.
Yeah, no, for sure. And a lot of the work that I do, especially with sexual trauma survivors, involves, you know, allowing the fight response to complete, whether it's landing a punch or a kick or slamming a door or, you know, those kinds of things. Again, using our imagination, making sure that they're never allowed or seeing them hauled off in handcuffs in your mind's eye or whatever it is that needs to happen. It's your world. You get to write the script that when those things happen and it's visceral. And I just did this like peace thing with the couple. But when I do it differently with the other side of what you're talking about and balanced, is that if somebody says about their abuser that they want to tell them to fuck off and I'm like, yeah, like how? Well, like, fuck off. And I'm like, yeah, fuck off. And they'd be like, oh, fuck off. And I'd be like, yeah, fuck off. Fuck off. Fuck off. And you'll see that the whole system in the client will start to shift. As they're finally hearing, not just what's in their mind about what they wished, but they voiced it. And I'm just echoing it and reflecting it back relationally. And that, because it is vibrational, also has a shift in the here and now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like you're kind of, attunement is central to it, right? You're just, you're attuning to like the intensity of what's actually there and helping them to kind of dial the graphic equalizer so that their body is connected with what it wants to say rather than it's just saying stuff. Well, no, feel it as you say it at the level of intensity that's actually there. And this whole skill set of helping that person to kind of find that sweet spot. So thank you for expressing that level of intensity, and that level of intensity happens in our clinical work, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So we just need to nurture that skill set to go in both directions. So thank you for embodying that.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. I mean, it's a both and like anything. And, you know, yeah. I mean, the goal is to just reflect the range of human experience, you know, to have some ability to, you know, not be so brittle and rigid. Or formulaic, you know, to be able to have some possibility for modulation and expansion and diminishment or contraction also.
Great. Well, thank you. I think we'll come to a close now. I really appreciate you coming on the show, Frances.
Sure. It was fun. I had a good time.
Good. Yeah, me too. I really appreciate the breadth of it. And there was like the totem animal, I think, for the discussion was the dog.
Yeah, yeah.
Really took us places. So I appreciate that and just how it unfolded spontaneously.
Yeah, me too. No, I appreciate it. Yeah. And I don't even have dogs. I like them, but I have cats. So whatever. It's just, it's who came today. So it works.
Yeah. All right. Well, sounds good.
Thank you for listening to The Boundless Body with the Somatic Doctor. Please leave a comment, subscribe, and like us on social media.
We're a swarm, we're a colony, we're a multiplicity.
Until next time, be well.